Welcome to the Talking Tall Rounds series, brought to you by the Seidel and Arnold Miller Family Heart, Vascular, and Thoracic Institute at Cleveland Clinic.
Hello, Amit. Hello, Tall Rounds, Talking Tall Rounds podcast guests. I'm Eric Roselli, and we're here to discuss a really growing area of super specialization within the field of cardiovascular medicine and surgery, cardio-obstetrics. I have the pleasure of being with Amit Gopal once again to speak about this excellent Tall Round session that we had. Amit, you want to tell us about our first speaker and the case that was presented?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Dr. Roselli, I really enjoyed this Tall Rounds. I think cardiovascular disease in general is a high-stakes field, but cardio-OB is a whole different ballgame. You know, first up, I had my co-fellow and colleague, Dr. Erica Hutt, who presented a case. This is a story of a 29-year-old female G1P0 who had a history of bicuspid aortic valve with associated aortopathy, a known ascending aortic aneurysm that had been stable over the past 2 years at 45 millimeters and associated with moderate AR. But during pregnancy, and I think we'll talk a little bit about why this may happen, the rate of dilation accelerated to the point of getting from 45 millimeters to 49 millimeters by the 29th week of pregnancy. And given rapid progression, thankfully this was recognized, first of all, at our local facility, but she was referred to the Cleveland Clinic and for evaluation and management. And I'm excited to learn from you, Dr. Roselli, later about the approach to aortic surgery during the different trimesters of pregnancy. But the approach for her was to pursue an elective cesarean at 35 weeks, 4 days with a healthy baby. She was discharged in good health and returned at post-op day 18 for a successful elective aortic and aortic valve repair.
Amit, the Goyle family has seen all of the changes directly that happened with pregnancy in your own home very much recently, right? and now all the changes to your home in that postpartum period of time, even in a normal state, it's always amazing for me to appreciate what a woman's body goes through. But our first speaker was Stephen Bakak, who's a primary care physician with a specialization in maternal fetal medicine. And he went through in his discussion some of those changes, which are, sort of obvious to everybody on the outside what happens. But I think particularly important when we think about cardiovascular health, what happens at the micro level to vascular structures and also physiologic state. That really puts a whole lot of added stress on someone who's vulnerable.
Yeah, so Dr. Stephen Bosak, who's one of our MFM specialists here, taught us about the physiologic changes that occur in pregnancy. And it's just remarkable the types of changes, hemodynamic, physiologic, hormonal, that occur to support the growing baby in the gravid uterus. You know, the mediators of a lot of these changes are neurohormonal, estrogen, progesterone, relaxin, and BNP. But the physiologic changes, the hemodynamic changes, include a rise in the plasma volume as much as 50% in singleton pregnancies, and in my wife's case, up to 70% in twins. This is associated with a change in arterial vascular remodeling to help accommodate that increased volume and a decrease in osmotic pressure, predisposing to third spacing. At the same time, the systemic and the pulmonary vascular resistances go down by about 20 to 30% with a commensurate decrease in blood pressure. Stroke volume goes up, heart rate goes up, and the product of the two, cardiac output goes up. But in the normal healthy pregnancy, the filling pressures should stay the same. But we can imagine in a normal healthy pregnancy, these changes may bring about some symptoms like air hunger with progesterone, maybe some leg edema. But with specific cardiovascular lesions, especially stenotic lesions, that may have been asymptomatic prior to these changes, can really manifest during pregnancy and make the whole childbearing process difficult and, if not, dangerous. You know, we also know that the pregnancy is a hypercoagulable state with a rise in fibrinogen and other procoagulants, especially with the associated venous stasis and decreased mobility. So it's just some of the changes that happen within the context of pregnancy. We'll talk a little bit more about the changes that happen surrounding labor and delivery, but really it becomes very clear how, for example, a patient with subclinical mitral stenosis pre-pregnancy may come in with decomposite heart failure during pregnancy.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And we hear from one of our real leaders in adult congenital heart disease, Joanna Gobriel, who's not only a person who's trained in dealing with the pathology that we see in those adult congenital heart patients, but a person who takes a particular interest in cardio-obstetrics. And she provides us a really nice discussion of cardiac changes in congenital heart disease in the pregnant patient.
Yeah, you know, with this talk is a must listen for anyone taking care of women of childbearing age. And, you know, she set the stage for us. The leading cause of maternal mortality is cardiovascular disease. And, you know, up to a quarter are preventable. And so, you know, we'll play her full talk for the audience. And I'll give you guys five questions to think about that she's going to answer for us shortly. Number one, which cardiovascular conditions carry the greatest risk for the mother? Number two, in high-risk patients, which route of delivery is generally preferred, and what are the exceptions, being vaginal delivery or cesarean? Number three, which heart failure medications can be continued during pregnancy and then later during lactation? Number four, what is the approach to anticoagulation during the different trimesters and peri-delivery? And number five, in which circumstances should pregnancy termination be considered?
Yeah, it's going to be really nice to listen to her talk with those questions in mind. Thank you. Thank you for that. She not only sets us up for what happens in that at-risk patient, but then we hear from one of our obstetricians who has a particular focus on high-risk patients, Catherine Singh, who discusses the plans that are made when we have a patient who has the need for a high-risk labor and delivery situation due to cardiovascular risk in that peripartum state. She first discusses some of the peripartum physiology details, and then I really appreciate that she really sets us up in a very practical sense with a discussion about how to be prepared with a delivery plan, who and how we should all be involved in those situations.
Yeah, you know, we talked about all of the changes that happen during the course of the weeks of weeks and months of pregnancy, but, you know, the circumstances surrounding labor and delivery in those hours to, you know, a handful of days, the entire hemodynamic profile sort of gets turned upside down on its head, right? If you just take the preload, for example, it may increase, one, from uterine contractions with auto transfusion of 300 to 500 cc's of blood at a time. And, you know, we can just imagine how gently and gingerly we replace blood for a patient with, for example, critical aortic stenosis, right? And this is happening as a bolus very quickly. We have relief of IVC compression as a gravid uterus moves away, you know, so you get increased filling reaching the right heart. The IV fluids given during labor and delivery, for example, in a C-section, can approach 1 to 3 liters. It's a lot of fluid the heart's going to have to deal with. But at the same time, you may have unpredictable blood loss. Even for a normal vaginal uncomplicated delivery, it's 500 cc's or a liter for a C-section, and that's not counting complicated deliveries. The blood pressure may rise during labor as a consequence of the pain and the catecholamine surge. And this is relevant for the anesthetic approach. But the blood pressure also may go down as you lose SVR during spinal or epidural anesthesia. During the second stage of labor, the cardiac output can rise by 50%. And labor itself can go on for days, as you know, my wife learned during our the birth of our first child. So there's a lot of changes that go on. And, you know, if cardiac lesions become problematic during pregnancy, they can become acutely problematic and life-threatening during the labor and delivery period. And so, you know, as Dr. Roselli, as you said, the questions that surround the delivery plan are important and have to be made with a team of multidisciplinary experts. You know, who should be there? Where should it be performed? When, during what stage of pregnancy should we plan this, and how to do it, you know, in terms of vaginal or cesarean?
Well, not only are there drastic changes, as you described, but they can happen really quickly. And so one of the things that we've learned, you know, dealing with some of the sickest patients in the realm of cardiothoracic surgery and cardiovascular interventions and the things we deal with every day at the Cleveland Clinic, is that what sets us apart is our ability to rescue patients. And it really is, that success is completely dependent upon having the whole team prepared with a plan. And a really critical element of that team is our cardiothoracic anesthesiologists, who not only are prepared for a patient like the one we heard to sort of lead off this tall rounds, who underwent an elective operation in the peripartum period, but also to be prepared when things have to move quickly, when there's a problem during the pregnancy, during the delivery, or any time surrounding when we're in that state of complex physiology. And so Jennifer Hargrave, who's just a really amazing cardiothoracic anesthesiologist, discusses with us, again, another discussion of physiology that is critical to hear from a cardiothoracic anesthesiologist, because they're also adding other elements of stress and things that change that physiology in the process.
You know, her talk gave me so much appreciation for the level of decision-making that goes into these critical moments of providing anesthesia around labor and delivery. Like you said, things can be quick and unpredictable, and there are a lot of variables at play. She said the three main considerations, you know, that she goes through in her mind are, one, like, what's the cardiac physiology in that patient's, in that circumstance, you know, the volume status, how dependent is the patient on the preload, and the impact of excess afterload. Number two, what are the anesthetic options available to us, and, you know, which would be best suited for that patient's physiology? And number three, what's the approach to delivery? Because, of course, that'll have an impact on what we do. And, you know, speaking of the anesthetic options, you know, she introduced this concept of a cardiac epidural. And, you know, we think back to the stress of labor and delivery, the pain, the catecholamine surge. Imagine you have increase in inotropy, chronotropy, SVR, blood pressure, afterload, and all these demands on the heart go up. And can really be dangerous in certain circumstances, right? If you have a coarctation, if you have an erythropathy, this is like the inverse of impulse control, right? Certain cardiomyopathies may not tolerate this very well. And so there's an impetus to provide epidural early on to blunt the sympathetic surge, to provide what they call a low cardiac output delivery, really just an early neuraxial intervention. But of course, things are even more complicated if a patient needs open heart surgery with cardiopulmonary bypass during pregnancy. And you know, Dr. Rosalia, I'd love to hear from you. What are some of the concerns in your mind when you're thinking about putting a pregnant patient on cardiopulmonary bypass? Of course, you know, you imagine there's a high fetal mortality, and you know, patient may have uterine contractions and placental hypoperfusion and fetal hypoxia. But what are the factors that you're weighing when you're taking that patient to the OR?
I'll tell you, the hardest decision is always whether we should go to the OR or not. And the timing of it, it's never lost on anybody on the entire team that does what we do, the fact that we consider mortality a real, very real kind of complication that occurs with heart surgery, even in the most kind of elective cardiac operations. We all have this kind of constant sense that things can change and we can lose a patient. But of course, in these situations, the mortality can be 200%, right? The tricky part is that plan of timing when to address it. I know that we heard from Dr. Gobriel about some of the congenital heart disease that put patients at risk, but we're seeing a growing appreciation for the prevalence of aortic disease, not just in patients with known syndromes like Marfan syndrome, where there's a little more data about sort of what happens to those patients, but patients in general. So a lot of aortic surgery is elective. We certainly have patients who show up with aortic dissection in the middle of a pregnancy. But our first commitment is to the patient who arrives. It is to the mother. With a dedicated team coming together, we can often save both the mother and the child. It's also always very interesting to me to hear how a lot of these patients get a lot of different stories about what their risks are. And I think there's a lack of appreciation about how we can manage patients through their pregnancy, even when they have cardiovascular risk. So certainly a patient who's in the midst of an acute dissection where both lives are threatened right away, is a patient that needs to get to the operating room immediately. But most other patients, we can treat them medically and optimize them to pick that sort of ideal window of safety for both the mother and the child.
Yeah, you know, these are critical decision points in a very high-stakes situation. And I'm excited for the audience to hear your talk on cardiac surgery in pregnancy, especially within the context of aortopathies. And you know, the five questions I'll ask them to consider as they wait to listen to the talk are, number one, what are the typical indications for cardiac surgery during pregnancy? Number two, what impact does pregnancy have on the aortopathy itself? Number three, for patients with Marfan's syndrome who want to become pregnant, at what diameter should they have elective aortic repair before conception? Number four, what is the recommended route of delivery for patients with an aortic aneurysm? And number five, what is the approach for pregnant patients who present with an aortic dissection? So again, very, very high stakes, but you know, these circumstances, these moments are so dire and scary and terrifying for the patients. I remember our last pregnancy was pretty challenging. There was a lot of nausea and difficulty, you know, eating and weight loss and things like this. But there was never a point where we were worried for my wife's life or for the life of our babies. You know, Dr. Roselli, when these patients come to you, what is your approach to counseling and educating these patients, their partners, their families?
You know, it's one of calm, really. We have to really help people by providing them the knowledge to address their fears. Our first child was born quite prematurely. My wife's water broke at 29 weeks and we had to delay the pregnancy. And so I can appreciate the fears that someone has when a pregnancy goes awry or they have news of, you know, that potential risk to the baby or the mother. Certainly nothing like an aortic dissection, but I have a bit of appreciation for that. And the one thing that my wife and I always talked about when we went through that phase was that we weren't going to let ourselves be caught up in the fear until we knew what we had to fear. And I think that's the same kind of approach I take with the patients is, we say, listen, this is the things we know. We image patients frequently. We monitor the babies closely, make our decisions based on the knowledge that we can gather and the facts at hand. And by staying sort of calm and using kind of that approach to it, it really helps to put the mother and the family in a good state, which isn't just emotional care. I think by having the patients reassured, it also affects their physiology. And in the end, there's nothing more satisfying than sort of seeing, you know, a mother get through that. I have a couple patients who had been through those situations and then, you know, send me Christmas cards with the subsequent children that they've had after some of those, you know, scary times. And it's just, it's a special sort of experience, I suppose.
Yeah, I can only imagine. You know, these are the moments that remind us why we do what we do and that we're taking care of people. You know, they've got their values and thoughts and feelings. And, you know, when they come to you, they're putting their lives in your hands and in the rest of the heart team's hands. And, you know, staying calm, I'm sure, is really helpful because they'll template their emotions off of your emotions. I remember that article you showed of a mother enjoying the miracle of life of herself and her baby. I think that was a patient that was sometime around the holiday season that came to you and survived her dissection, was it?
Yeah, it's a pretty awesome story. She had a dissection right after birth in the postpartum period. And and I'll share her story because it's, you know, it was in the newspaper and she's happy to share it. But she was an older mother. And so this was a particularly trying time just for them to get pregnant. And then so to have any of that at risk kind of just added to that whole element of uncertainty. What I didn't tell in the story, which I'm going to tell now, which is really cool, is that connection that we've had has continued. So her son, who's doing fantastic, required some congenital heart surgery. Dr. Najem performed his operation, but they asked that I assist him in the case. It was a simple repair, and he's going to have a great long-term outcome from it. It was just really special to sort of reaffirm that kind of lifelong connection that I have with her and her child and her whole family. Several years later when he had to go in for a VSD repair. I guess it's okay to get a little sentimental in the holiday season and in this crazy year 2020. But it's this cardio OB that, you know, really brings you close to kind of an entire family that way, which is, makes it a really neat specialty to, and an area to focus on. And, we've recruited a really wonderful woman, Deidre Martina, who is a cardio OB specialist who comes to us after being really interested in this topic for several years and helping to lead our effort. And she gets to take care of patients in these situations on a regular basis and talks to us next about postpartum care and monitoring.
You know, we're at the bedside taking care of one individual patient, and in this case, two patients with a mom and the baby at a time, like the patient you took care of on the holidays. But at the same time, we zoom out and we take a look at the whole population and think about what are the factors at play that affect population health, right? And so thinking about the epidemiology of maternal health, in the U.S., pregnancy-related morbidities have increased by 50% in the past decade alone. You know, and we think with our, you know, our technology and, you know, the, hopefully, you know, we'd like to believe improved access to care and the heart team model, things should be better. But, you know, why are things worsening? And, you know, part of that is why we have poor outcomes is that patients are coming older with advanced maternal age, and they're coming with more comorbidities. You know, if you just take a look at the AHA's Life Simple 7, you know, the important features for good cardiovascular health, good diet, staying active, not smoking, having a good weight, and optimized blood pressure, cholesterol, glucose. If you take a look at women aged 20 to 44, only 5% are in ideal cardiovascular health, right? And so when we take a look at the field, the arena of cardio OB health, really it's about population health. It's about preventive health and the efforts that go into that, from, you know, a doctor counseling the patient during a well visit at the age of 20 to, you know, to health policies. There's a lot that goes into that, but, you know, clearly we're not doing a great job. The United States, right, the U.S. ranks 64th in the world for maternal mortality. 40% of deaths in moms are related to cardiovascular conditions, and 70% occur within the first postpartum year. Shocking. Over 50%, yeah, shocking indeed. You know, but the saving grace here is that over 50% is preventable, right? And so the silver lining is with a coordinated effort, we can have an impact. And you know, I appreciate that Dr. Martina highlighted the healthcare inequities that are at play. Black women have a greater than twofold higher risk of maternal mortality. And thinking about health policy and why politics and getting out and voting and these kinds of things are important, you know, half of pregnancies are covered by Medicaid in the U.S. And before the Affordable Care Act, they only covered the mom's health for the first 60 days postpartum. And remember, Dr. Martina taught us that 70% of maternal mortality occurs within the first postpartum year. And a third occurs within the first 6 weeks, right? And so 60 days is not sufficient. With the Affordable Care Act, many states chose to expand coverage to provide more adequate postpartum care, but there were 14 states did not expand coverage. So there are a lot of patients that just don't have access to the kind of care that, you know, our advanced heart teams are able to provide. It's something that is important for us as a society.
I agree. There's no question we can do better. And it absolutely requires the entire community of the United States to focus on it. It's the same thing we see with other major health problems like the opioid epidemic. We can't ignore these things. We have to kind of pay attention and do more than pay attention. We need to support the efforts to improve what we do for people in these situations. There's no easy solutions, but the most important thing is to certainly bring attention to it first. And as health caregivers, even in the cardiovascular, you know, specialized world that we work and live in, these are things that we should be thinking about. It's crazy that that we're 64th in the world for maternal mortality. Come on. Yeah. We definitely can do better. And, you know, the preventive health is really important part of the care that we deliver. And we finished this session with Leslie Cho, who helps to direct that umbrella of centers for us. And she gave us a, a nice a tight sort of review of what's happening in her group with the postpartum clinics here.
Yeah, you know, so we said that the care of the pregnant patient begins well before they become pregnant, right? And well person visits and health maintenance checks. But the care should continue well after labor and delivery. You know, we have this concept of the fourth trimester, right? The first 12 weeks after delivery and the physiologic changes that happen there. But adverse pregnancy conditions like gestational diabetes or hypertensive disorders of pregnancy, you know, IUGR, preterm birth, these are long-lasting risk factors and indicate a long-term atherosclerotic cardiovascular risk for the mother. And so, you know, Dr. Cho outlined the approach that we have to this at the Cleveland Clinic with strong ties to our MFM and cardio and obstetric colleagues, where patients who are deemed high risk, who've had these adverse pregnancy conditions, get plugged into our preventive clinic within 3 months postpartum and get a follow-up for a long time. So I think the key thing is an organizational structure that puts the disparate parts of cardio OB heart team together, identifies patients who are high risk, and there's a mechanism at play that can follow these patients for screening, for counseling, and for treating.
Yeah, I mean, it's really one of my favorite things about what's been happening since we started all these Tall Round series is the way that we bring so many people from different disciplines together. Lately it's been in a single location and delivering our message virtually. But nonetheless, even just this 1 hour that that a group spends together sort of sharing a little bit of their knowledge also helps to foster other sparks of collaboration. And I know that this group that we heard from in this Tall Rounds is going to continue to find better ways to work together to study these disease states and better ways for us to deliver better care within the cardio-obstetrics realm. For those of you listening, I hope you enjoyed this discussion. And please join us also online. For a complimentary CME, you'll be able to watch and hear the talks at the same time and hear the speakers delivering them. And as always, we really appreciate you joining Amit Goyal and I on our Talking Tall Rounds podcast, and we'll hope to talk to you again soon. Next, we'll hear from Joanna Gobriel, specialist in adult congenital heart disease and cardio-obstetrics.
Good morning, everyone. So my name is Joanna Gobriel. I am part of the ACHC team and cardio OB team as well. I'll be discussing congenital heart disease in pregnancy, and this is a brief outline, and I'll try and cover that in 7 minutes, but that's very difficult to do. Now, cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of maternal death. It's about 20 to 25%. But importantly, up to a fourth of these deaths can actually be prevented if these women are referred in a timely manner to either an expert center or any cardiology or cardio OB center. And we will all be seeing more pregnant women with cardiovascular disease, not just because women with congenital heart disease are surviving because of improved surgery, but also because we have more women that have diabetes, hypertension, obesity, we have a rise in maternal age, we have also advanced multi-fetal pregnancies because of fertility techniques, and then increased in recognition. Now, the most important part, I think, of this whole presentation and this Tall Rounds is the multidisciplinary team approach. You have OB, you have cardiology, genetics, anesthesia, vascular, radiology, CT surgeon, neonatology. And at the heart of this, I think, is the cardio OB nurse. That's Sandy Keene's picture right here. She is the one that the patient will often talk to all the time, and she's the glue to this whole cardio OB team in our clinic. So with congenital heart disease, preconception is key, and you want to start early with these patients in their teen years, because it's not just about the risk to mom. Oftentimes a patient will come to me, they'll be like, I'm willing to take the risk, but it's also the risk to the baby, the offspring, with prolonged comorbidities lifelong. And importantly, you want to give them family support. If they're going to go through a high-risk pregnancy, they need to have enough support to go through that. Contraception is key, and I think that'll be covered by my colleagues. And genetic counseling is important, and it's no longer that kind of one number that we give all patients. It's actually very individualized now. You want to give them, whether this is an autosomal dominant inheritance like Marfan or something far more less inherited like TGA. And there's all these things in between, such as bicuspid, which is, can be up to 10% in families, or Epstein up to 6%. Now, when it comes to maternal risk classification, first there was CARPREC, that was in 2001 or so. Then Zahara came, then the modified WHO that Erica mentioned. And then CARPREC 2 is kind of the newer version of CARPREC, which incorporates more factors to it. And just to kind of be brief, the modified WHO is the one that we, I think we all use. I think CARPREC 2 would be very helpful to even risk to stratify the WHO groups even further into more risk categories. Very briefly, Zahara, just to kind of see, the most high risk here is going to be a mechanical heart valve and left heart obstruction. And that's going to be a theme you see in all the risk scores. And then the higher the risk score, obviously the higher maternal morbidities and mortality. This is the CARPREC 2, and I'm just going to mention it briefly. Again, you see mechanical valve and left heart obstruction, low EF. You want to see poor functional class and prior cardiac events in the mom. These are very high risk. CAD, pulmonary hypertension, aortopathies. But importantly, and I think they did a very good job in adding late pregnancy assessment. Again, it emphasizes that the earlier these women come and get evaluated, the better off they do. Now let's kind of delve a little bit more into the modified WHO that Erica mentioned. I think the class one and class two are not going to be necessarily the ones that we see in cardio OB clinic. These are lower risk. Class one is like a small PDA, mild pulmonary stenosis, your repaired ASDs and some ectopy on monitor. Your class two, again, lower risk, an unrepaired ASD, which can tolerate pregnancy very well, or repaired tetralogy of Fallot. And most arrhythmias are actually fairly well tolerated during pregnancy, and we can manage them well during pregnancy. It's really the class two to three, where you have a maternal risk of 17.7%, the class three and the class four, where actually pregnancy is not recommended. So your class two to three, you have mild LV impairment and hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, your native and your prosthetic valvular heart disease, your repaired coarctation, and then your aortopathies. And it depends on the type of aortopathy. So for Marfan, which is higher risk, your ascending aorta less than 40 is a class two to three, whereas bicuspid is 45, that tends to be the number that puts it into a two to three category. Class three, we're talking about 28.9% maternal risk here. Mechanical valves, again, very high risk, and LVOT obstruction, again. So severe asymptomatic AS and moderate MS. A systemic RV does not handle pregnancy as well as a left ventricle. We all know that. So any good or mild function, mild dysfunction of a systemic RV will still be high risk. Unrepaired cyanotics and Fontan, and it depends on the status of the Fontan. If it's a compensated Fontan, for example, with a systemic left ventricle, they tend to do better than the ones that are decompensated or the ones with a systemic right ventricle. And then again, the aortopathies, and it depends again on the type of aortopathy. For example, Louise Dietz with an ascending aorta that is greater than 40 is fairly high risk. Class four, your pulmonary arterial hypertension always falls in class four. It's always not recommended for pregnancy. Your LVEF less than 30%, your severe mitral stenosis or severe symptomatic aortic stenosis, severe coarctation, which is kind of a double hit here, because not only do you have severe hypertension on the actual myocardium, but you also have decreased perfusion to the placenta in these pregnant women. Again, systemic RV with moderate to severe dysfunction, a decompensated Fontan, and the dilated Marfans, bicuspid aortopathies, and vascular EDS, which is the class type 4. Just bear in mind, obviously, that the higher the modified WHO score, the worse the fetal outcomes are in all these categories. And as I mentioned, it depends on the WHO class. The 1 and 2s can actually be followed locally in their local hospital, whereas the 2 to 3, the 3 and the 4 should be seen in an expert center. And their follow-up really depends on their lesion and how compensated and how sick they are. It can be anywhere between every 2 months to every week, and sometimes we admit these patients to the hospital for very careful monitoring. So for labor and delivery, Dr. Singh, I think we'll actually go into delve into this a little bit in more details, but you want to minimize pain and exertion in these women. Position can be supine, but always consider a lateral decubitus to improve venous return because that the abdomen can actually decrease the IVC flow. Now, our vaginal delivery is always our default, unless dictated otherwise, either for OB reasons or specific lesions. So, for example, the very high-risk aortopathies, sometimes we do go to C-section to have very meticulous hemodynamic control, or the ones that have mechanical prosthesis, sometimes we will need to do that. We do recommend a slow cardiac epidural. GA has more hemodynamic instability. And induction can be needed sometimes when you need a very specific timeline. So again, for a mechanical prosthesis, if you need to stop warfarin, get them onto unfractionated heparin, and then proceed to delivery, then you might need to induce these patients. Oxytocin is fine as long as you do a slow infusion to avoid hypotension. You don't want to use tacrolytics because they have tachycardia and arrhythmia side effects. We do tend to use an assisted second stage if it's prolonged, such as forceps and vacuum, and Dr. Singh will delve into that more too. Now, during delivery, the monitoring can range anywhere from just pulse oximetry and blood pressure every 15 minutes to actually having an arterial line the whole time for very high-risk lesions, such as, again, dilated aortopathies. You do want to use bubble filters. That's very important in patients that have residual shunting. As you're pushing with the Valsalva, you're shunting more right to left, which is higher risk for paradoxical embolism. And we do use endocarditis prophylaxis for prosthetic materials in cyanotic patients. When it comes to drugs, there's obviously, this is a very short list of the drugs, but I just want to emphasize that aspirin can be used both during pregnancy and lactation. Most of your heart failure medications can be used once the baby is delivered. The ones that you cannot use during pregnancy are going to be your ACE, your ARBs, your aldosterone receptor blockers, and your Entresto. We don't have data on certain medications. When it comes to PH drugs, the PDE5, so sildenafil can be used, prostacyclins can be used, but not your bosentan, your ERAs. With anticoagulation, the big picture is when it comes to warfarin, I think, and Lovenox. Warfarin is great for anticoagulation. It's very good for mechanical valves, and it's very good for the mom. Low molecular weight heparin does not cross the placenta, so it's very good for the baby because it doesn't have any side effects, because warfarin has that embryopathy, especially in the first trimester. Not only that, but it can also cause intracranial hemorrhage in the second trimester too. So it's going to be a very fine balance of what medication to use in patients that need anticoagulation, whether the Fontans that are higher risk or the mechanical prosthesis. So if you have a patient who's been tolerating low-dose warfarin, less than 5 milligrams, and doing well with a therapeutic INR throughout, then you keep them on that because we know that the risk of embryopathy with such a low dose is fairly low. However, if they need more than 5 milligrams, then you do want to switch them in the first trimester to Lovenox and then switch them back at 12 weeks to warfarin. Importantly, Lovenox is not a fixed dose. It is a dose-adjusted dosing. So you want to check the anti-10A levels every 2 weeks until you kind of reach that level, because you will have to increase the dosage as the pregnancy progresses, and that's important too. Really briefly, high-risk lesions, aortopathies, preconception, and bicuspid. If your ascending aorta is already more than 50 or there is a fast rate of increase, you want to actually operate on these patients, emphasizing the importance of that preconception visit to actually decrease the risk of pregnancy. With Morfan, actually the recommendations, if it's ascending aorta more than 40 or the area to height ratio is more than 10. Now, during pregnancy, all these patients will end up getting beta blockers. You can use echo to monitor them, but you can also use MRI without gadolinium to monitor these patients. During pregnancy, again, you might need to actually intervene on these patients and either terminate the pregnancy or do surgery at the time. And then delivery, you can do a vaginal with an assisted second stage, or sometimes we do C-section with an A-line for very meticulous monitoring, and if we need to use a TEE to monitor risk of dissection. And then importantly, and Dr. Mazzino will actually cover this, I'm sure, very well, is the postpartum high risk of dissection in these patients. They need to be seen after delivery very closely in that 4 to 6 week period. Now, I'm not going to have time to cover all these high risk lesions, unfortunately, but just to kind of, in broadly, every patient needs to be individualized, because one Fontan, it's not going to fit all. You can have a Fontan, as I said, with systemic LV versus a systemic RV. It's a very big difference in risk overall, and they all need to be counseled closely. With valvular stenosis, know that you can do interventional procedures while they're pregnant. It's preferably during the second trimester after 20 weeks or so, and you want to limit radiation. This is going to be balloon valvuloplasty for either aortic or mitral valves. Arrhythmias are fairly well tolerated, as I said, and you can cardiovert these patients. And you do need to have the very difficult discussion of termination, especially in the super high-risk patients. We're talking Eisenmenger, pulmonary arterial hypertension with RV dysfunction, severe LVOT obstruction with LV dysfunction, and the PAH and Fontan patients, depending on how sick they are. I will answer any COVID questions, I think, after this for the sake of time. But importantly, it's really a team effort to take care of these very complex patients with preconception, care during pregnancy, and the postpartum care. Thank you.
And now, very excited to learn from Dr. Roselli himself about the role of cardiac surgery in the pregnant patient.
Cardiac surgery in pregnancy is typically something that occurs only in the severest situations, fortunately. As we heard from this team of experts working across disciplines, most of the times these patients are managed in such a way that they don't need to come to an operation. We've heard about the various classifications, but really the highest risk patients, the ones that come to surgery, are the patients not only with these various high risk lesions, but the ones that have those lesions affected in a severe state. We heard Jen talked about this Mayo Clinic series. It's small, but many places have had some experience. We haven't written ours up, but we probably have a similar number of patients that we've operated on. In Dr. Estefano's paper, he talked about mitral stenosis related to rheumatic disease being the most common thing. Well, that was in 1976. Nowadays, we don't see that problem as much, thank goodness. And it's more aortic problems that we see that bring patients to the operating room. In this series from the Mayo Clinic, they talked about the need for cardiac surgery for a whole bunch of other problems, mostly congenital disease. And those were patients who had to undergo surgery in the early terms of their pregnancy, and they still were able to save quite a few of them. But again, the problem we see most commonly now that takes us to the OR is complications related to the aorta. And what we know is that when a patient is pregnant, they will have changes in their aorta. And so if they have an underlying aortic problem, hopefully we know about it before they get pregnant, but that's not always the case. Structurally, we see that there are changes histologically in the walls of the aorta with increased elastin fragmentation, probably related to some direct hormonal effects. Physiologically, we've heard a lot about that from several of the speakers already. There are increases in maternal blood volume, heart rate, blood pressure, stroke volume, cardiac output, all putting added physiologic stress on these vulnerable aortic walls. And also, it's important to understand that during pregnancy, a patient with a bicuspid aortic valve or a coarctation will have increased gradients across those valves and those lesions. And a gravid uterus may even cause aortic iliac compression, which can increase the effects of hypertension. In this study, they looked at several patients with Marfan syndrome and compared a group of patients who were pregnant with those who were nulliparous, and found that the patients who had been pregnant had increased growth rates of their aorta during that pregnancy, and these rates of growth did not return to baseline after the pregnancy. So a Marfan's patient who gets pregnant or has been pregnant has a higher rate of growth, probably because of those changes, those structural changes we see in the walls of their already vulnerable aortas. They're patients who have to be monitored more closely, and we have to appreciate that. Fortunately, dissection in pregnancy is not very common. It's definitely way more common than it is in the regular population. In this study, where they looked at the nationwide or national inpatient sample, they found about a 7-fold increase over the general population with a rate of 4 in 10,000. They found 44 patients in over 10.5 million pregnancies and 41,000 dissections who had their dissection while pregnant. Interestingly, only 7 of those 44 had Marfans, and 2 had some other congenital anomalies. So 80% of these occurred in women without known congenital syndromes. As we're learning more, they may have actually had something that just wasn't identified at the time. But we have recommendations about repairing those aortas prior to pregnancy. And we heard about that from Dr. Gobriel. The ACC and ESC guidelines are pretty similar, and we heard about that, so I won't go over this list. But they're pretty close to the general recommendations for those patients, even without pregnancy. The ESC guidelines have some specific recommendations about the mode of delivery in these patients based on their aortic size. And we already heard from our team about that. C-section in the more severe cases, expedited vaginal delivery. I liked your point about how it can take 2 or 3 days, Kat. Certainly seemed like that with kids in my family. My wife would appreciate that. And that fear when you're in the middle of all that and you have an underlying problem just adds to the whole situation. But it's the high-risk OB team, along with cardiothoracic surgery, that allows us to rescue these patients when they do have a complication like aortic dissection. Typically, this emergency plan is to do an emergency C-section followed immediately by an aortic repair, and that's what we've done for patients who've had aortic dissections while pregnant. Right around the time when we moved our OB services off of this main campus, it was about 2007, I got a phone call for a patient up in Michigan who was pregnant and had an aortic dissection. It was a storm. There were no beds in Ann Arbor. They called, and we flew her down from Muskegon, and I called Tom Falcone and said, "Hey, Tom, you guys don't have any OB services here, but I'm going to deliver a baby in OR 42. And he incorporated the team really quickly, and we were able to save that lady. And of course, after that, you guys reorganized to make sure that you had high-risk services on campus all the time. But it was an aortic dissection that really brought that to our attention to make sure we needed to be on top of it. This table comes from a study out of China, which they described 30 patients with Marfan syndrome who had aortic dissection during pregnancy over a 21-year period of time. And this is the algorithm that they describe. And it's pretty straightforward and pretty easy to understand. We want to delay surgery as long as possible. So, in the patients that come in with a type A aortic dissection, the indication's the same. They've got to go to surgery, especially if the gestation is after 28 weeks. We do that combined C-section and surgical repair in a single stage. If it's a type B aortic dissection, it's uncomplicated on the right. Well, we treat it medically, and we try to hold out as long as possible. But if they have a complicated type B dissection where they're unstable or have malperfusion, the indications are the same as they are for that type B aortic dissection no matter what. Although we try and coordinate a C-section and the treatment, now we can do that with TVAR. Those are the ones where you combine your team and you can rescue these patients. And these are some pictures that they showed of them doing that in this paper. You can see acute aortic dissection on the left with a baby in the uterus on the CT scan image on the left that demonstrated that. The 3D reconstruction, baby in utero on left and giant aneurysm with dissection and a completed repair of the frozen elephant trunk and baby delivered CT scan on the right. Pretty impressive image. Those are the kind of things we can do. It's a lot trickier when you see the patient that has an earlier gestation but still has a hard indication for surgery to save the mother. You know, we're in this double jeopardy situation where you have maternal and fetal life at risk. And so in these situations, we, again, try to hold off as long as possible, but if we're before 28 weeks gestation, then we do aggressive maternal fetal monitoring and have to make serious decisions about continuation or termination of the pregnancy. You actually can get a patient and the fetus through an open operation, although it's very high risk. The CT scan images, again, from the same investigators but a different paper, shows that they were able to get that fetus through maturation despite having to reconstruct the arch in their patient, as shown in this CAT scan before and after on the left and the right. In this paper from Lanceman, he makes this very clear, I think, the thinking. In the first trimester, we try to repair and continue a pregnancy with fetal monitoring if that's what the family wishes. In the second trimester, the questions are most difficult, especially in that phase of how viable is the fetus going to be between 23 and 30 weeks. But if we're going to try and combine the things, we do an emergency C-section and the repair as indicated. We heard about the importance of cardiopulmonary bypass in pregnancy. Again, fetal monitoring is important. We want to avoid bradycardia. These fetuses are cardiac output rate dependent. That placenta, which is like the fetal oxygenator for us cardiothoracic surgeons and perfusionists, is, again, with only 65% saturated blood, there's an admixture of that blood. We want to maintain high flow, blood pressure, a hemoglobin above 9, and optimize pH so that we can optimize maximum maternal oxygen delivery. We want to avoid uterine contractions, and so hemodilution that happens on pump can lower progesterone levels and induce contractions. We want to avoid hypothermia. Sometimes it's not avoidable with an aortic dissection. And we want to avoid an increase in CVP, which can happen if you're running retrograde brain perfusion during brain protection. So we typically want to do selective antegrade brain perfusion if we have to circ arrest. In some systems, you can have pulsatile flow and your cardiopulmonary bypass pump, which increases the nitric oxide placental dilatation. You want to do that pulsatile flow at about 60 beats per minute with a 30% pulse width. In that study from China, they showed the maternal survival at certainly better than 50%, better than 60% at 6 years, and about 50% fetal survival. It is a serious problem, but these patients can do well. This review of trends over several periods, over like a 30-year period, showed that maternal mortality is significantly improving, and so is fetal mortality with the development of TEEMS. And I just show these two patients, which were particularly memorable for me. The one on the left is a young woman who had a coarctation repair at the age of 7 and was never followed for it. She went through labor for about 36 hours before they finally reverted to a C-section, and they got a chest x-ray post-op, and they found that her whole left chest was whited out from this 10-centimeter aneurysm related to her previous coarctation repair. Didn't rupture, thank God. And then we fixed it. And the one on the right is just was a really cool story. It was like a lead story in the Akron Journal on Christmas Day several years ago. A woman who had an aortic dissection right after delivering her baby. So the point about monitoring these patients really closely for 4 to 6 weeks or longer after the surgery is really critical. We were able to get her through emergency surgery, and that was many years ago, and her son is doing really well, and so is she. Thank you for this opportunity to talk.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. Like what you heard? Visit Tall Rounds online at clevelandclinic.org/tallrounds and subscribe for free access to more education on the go.